I want to give you a glimpse of the stories that you need to know about today. Here they are.
They haven't led to weakening Iran. Iran is more in control. We're finding out that Donald Trump has lost control.
Yo.
We never asked for a ceasefire, and we have never asked even for negotiation. We are ready to defend ourselves as long as it takes.
I'm really not afraid of anything.
Those are the latest videos and the latest stories, and this is the Sanchez Effect. Let's get to it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, the highest ranking official ever to resign in protest at the outset of a war has just done so. His name is Joe Kent. He is Donald Trump's director of counterterrorism. This is a very big gig. This is a very important security position. He thinks and is saying so that the war on Iran is wrong. As a matter of fact, he has put out a letter, and I have it right here. And I want to read it to you because I think it's that important. He says, after much reflection, I have decided to resign from my position as director of the National Counterterrorism Center effective today. I cannot in good conscience support the ongoing war in Iran. This is what he's saying. Iran posed no imminent threat to our nation. And it is clear that we started this war, talking about the United States, due to pressure from Israel and its powerful American lobby. This is one of the most important security guys in the United States who works directly for the president. I support the values of the foreign policies that you campaign in 2016, 2020, 2024. He goes on to say, in your administration, you understood better than any modern president how to decisively apply military power. But then he says, early in this administration, high-ranking Israeli officials and influential members of the American media deployed a misinformation campaign that wholly undermined your America First platform and sowed pro-war sentiments to encourage a war with Iran. This echo chamber was used to deceive you, Mr. President, into believing that Iran posed an imminent threat to the United States. He goes on. And that we should strike it now. There was a clear path to a swift victory, he says the president believed. This was a lie. This was a lie. And is the same tactic the Israelis used to draw us into the disastrous Iraq war that cost our nation the lives of thousands of our best men and women. We cannot make this mistake again. And then he says this, which I think is particularly meaningful. As a veteran who deployed to combat 11 times, and as a Gold Star husband who lost my beloved wife, Shannon, in a war manufactured by Israel, I cannot support sending the next generation off to fight and die in a war that serves no benefit to the American people nor justifies the cost of American lives. I pray, Mr. President, that you will reflect upon what we are doing in Iran and who we are doing it for. The time for bold action is now. You can reverse course and chart a new path for our nation, or you can allow us to slip further toward decline and chaos. You hold the cards. It was an honor to serve in your administration and to serve our great nation. Signed, Joseph Kent, Director, the National Counterterrorism Center. I mean, when I saw this within the last 24 hours, I was like, I'm pretty old. This didn't happen at the outset of Vietnam or Iraq or Korea or Afghanistan or any of these wars. Sure, a lot of people would write a letter like this, you know, a year later, maybe even 2 or 3 months later. But this is in the second week when this guy's coming out and saying there was no imminent threat. Essentially, this war is a lie, and we're not fighting it for Americans. We're fighting it for Israel. This is an American, one of the top guys in the Trump administration. And by the way, he's not the only one out there saying this. Other very, very prominent Americans are saying this. Look at Robert Pape, for example. This guy's one of the world's foremost experts on wars, geopolitics, and the history of interventions. He's a University of Chicago guy. And so this is a serious man. This is a smart man. Listen to what he says.
They haven't led to weakening Iran. Iran is more in control of world's oil than it was 18 days ago. If we cross these Rubicons here, then we really are probably in Vietnam territory. What's happening here is it's the illusion of control. We're finding out that Donald Trump has lost control.
Look, the U.S. is trying to win right now by the sheer force of its airstrikes. Everybody who knows anything about this will tell you air forces don't win wars, right? The other thing that the U.S. is doing right now is they're trying to pick off by assassinating, essentially, some would say murdering, Iranian leaders. They've already killed a bevy of them, as you know. They began with the Ayatollah, and yesterday they killed two more. Now, it's the IDF that's doing this and the Israelis who are claiming responsibility. These are the two men who died last night. Ali Larijani, you heard about him. He was a security official. He was one of the guys that the United States was negotiating with. This is one of the guys who was trying to diminish the capacity to produce nukes, right? The IDF says they killed him, and Iran has confirmed it. The IDF also say they assassinated Brigadier General Gholam Reza Soleimani. He's the head of Iran's Basij forces. By the way, no relation to the other Soleimani that was killed by Mr. Trump in his last administration. And the Basij, in case you don't know, are Iran's internal security forces. Now, in response to all of this, as you might imagine, Iran has launched a barrage of missiles targeting Israel. Take a look. This thing's looking more and more like a hellfire every day. RT Middle East correspondent Charlotte Dubinsky is in Jerusalem. She's been following this development. So last night, the assassinations, and now Iran says, oh, yeah, look what we're going to do to you. So I guess the question, Charlotte, is what did they do?
Well, what they did, Rick, was send four salvos of missiles. That was just overnight. We've had more today. There have been several impact sites across mainly central Israel. I was at one of those sites just in the last few hours. This is a place called Ramat Gan, which is fairly close to Tel Aviv, so really center of Israel. And that's where what the IDF say were parts of cluster missiles hit apartments, blocks, set fires, smashed cars, killed an elderly couple managing to damage their apartment. We're told they just simply didn't have time to get to their safety room. This is a couple in their 70s. They were found both together, one of their walkers right next to them. Just not enough time. And that is something I'm hearing from so many people now on the ground, is that, yes, we're getting emergency alerts. Yes, the sirens are ringing, but they're not always giving people the time that they need to get to safety. When this all started, well, just under 3 weeks ago, we were normally getting these alerts about 10 minutes before anything was impacting Israel. Now that's down sometimes to 1 to 2 minutes. It's simply not enough time. So in terms of the damage today, quite a lot, not when we compare it to, say, what's happening in Iran or what's happening in Beirut, but for what we've seen in Israel these last few days, we are now seeing consistently the cluster missiles, that's what the IDF says they are getting through this multi-layered air defense. And that's really concerning, because up until now, most Israelis have been like a bit like, ah, you know, it's a war. We hear the sirens, we go in the safe room, we leave, we're fine.
Yes.
We just carry on as it is. But now we're getting more and more deaths. Now we're getting more and more impact sites.
Yeah, see, what you just talked about is what I've been hearing as well, that, you know, in the past, Israelis were used to this kind of thing, going back and forth with Hezbollah and the 12-day war, et cetera. But that this time, it feels a little more pernicious. It feels a little more frightening. It feels like there may be less control. Is that a proper characterization?
I think it is. Do you know, I was actually talking to an expert just the other day, and we were talking about how the multi-layered defence systems work here in Israel. Things like the Iron Dome, which is much vaulted as being this incredible protection that Israel has. Well, the IDF says it's not hermetic, and we see that it's not hermetic. And this analyst was saying to me, the problem we've got when something like a cluster warhead is being used is that the dispersal is so large and so wide in such a short amount of time that the Iron Dome is essentially like a sieve. Something is going to get through. And that's what we're seeing right now. And I think people are realizing that, yes, they may not be seeing the casualties that we're seeing in other countries across the Middle East, particularly in Iran, but we are now seeing the number of dead mounting up. We've got 14 civilians having been killed in the past 3 weeks. We have got over 3,000 people who have gone to hospital for various levels of severity of injury. Still, we've got 5 people in a serious condition in hospital. And that means that maybe, you know, every couple of households, somebody is being impacted now. And that's not what we've seen in the last previous years, when Israel has felt perhaps a little bit more resistant to, you know, any attacks on its nation. All those attacks have been in specific areas, like in the north of Israel with Hezbollah rockets coming over, or, of course, in that green belt around Gaza. You know, things feel different now. You know, here in Jerusalem overnight, we had sirens once again. In fact, there were two lots of sirens in the middle of the night. It is every day. We've actually even seen strikes in the old city on the holy site. So, you know, this is happening now on a daily basis.
That's what I wanted to talk to you about also before I let you go. Fatigue. They call it war fatigue. The idea that just hearing the sirens freaks you out. Then you got to go to a bomb shelter somewhere. You're freaked out. At first, okay, fine, we do it. Now it's week three, and every day it's sirens, and every day it's a trip to the bomb shelter, and every day your phone doesn't work, and there is no internet, and you start feeling just generally fatigued about the war. That's got to have a psychological effect on the people of Israel in general, no?
Yeah, absolutely. I was speaking to some of the residents in Ramat Gan this morning, and they were saying, you know, last night we heard the sirens, we went into the bomb shelter, we woke up, we heard that there was a huge blast nearby, we found out that our neighbours had been killed. We come out, we're forcing ourselves to go for coffee this morning and breakfast because we have to keep some sense of normality. But we've also now got children who haven't been in schools for 3 weeks. And, you know, that's something that Israel is normally proud, that everybody goes back to doing what they do. I was in Tel Aviv a week ago and speaking to people there a few minutes after the sirens, and they were sitting out sunning themselves, and they're like, oh, this is normal. But I do think that that fatigue is creeping in now.
Yes.
And it is impacting people's lives. And I think you can see that people are suddenly starting to struggle, particularly when we were told that this could be quite quick. Now we're getting the IDF saying that it could be several weeks. Mm. Other people saying with the bombing of the gas and oil fields in Iran, and Iran saying it's going to retaliate, we could see this escalate even further.
And the problem is, it's not up to them. Usually the Israelis and the Americans have always felt a sense of control. This is our war. We decide when the war ends. The Iranians, you just heard them. We just played Arachi a little while ago. They're saying no. We'll decide when this war ends. It's kind of like they've turned the tables a little bit, and that's got to be a little unsettling, I imagine. And I guess that's where we'll leave it. Great reporting as usual, Charlotte. You do such a good job with this stuff, and you make us understand exactly. You draw a picture for us, as our old professors in journalism school used to say. Thank you, Charlotte. We appreciate it. All right.
Thank you.
According to the new reporting, and I think I may have mentioned this to you earlier, Mr. Trump is not telling the truth about his dealings with Iran. Mr. Trump is secretly reaching out to the Iranians and offering them a negotiated settlement of some kind just to get out of this thing. Trump, not the Iranians. He's doing it through back channels, possibly through Steve Witkoff. Now, obviously, he doesn't want Americans to find out that he's having somebody call the Iranians to try to get out of this thing, because he's got to be, you know, chest-thumping Mr. Bravado, right? But that may be too late, because the word is out. Trump has reached out to Foreign Minister Arachi and others, and they have told him, no thanks. No, sorry. We don't want to talk to you. We don't want to negotiate. We don't want to do a ceasefire. We don't trust you. And because we think the Iranians are saying. This is what they think. We're winning this war. We've got the leg up right now. So listen to this reporting by none other than Jeremy Scahill. He's one of the best reporters in the United States, a real reporter, a credible reporter, with a fantastic reputation and contacts to match. Watch.
I was told by a senior Iranian official that Steve Witkoff had sent WhatsApp messages to Iranian officials, including Abbas Araghchi, the country's foreign minister. And I said, oh, I want to go to Witkoff and ask him that. That's what I told the Iranians. And they said, well, you know, this is still off the record because we haven't figured out if we're going to respond or how we're going to deal with this. So I was, you know, I was sort of informed of this for several days. Mm-hmm. And then I kept pushing the Iranian sources. And I said, I want to go to Witkoff and ask him about this, because Trump keeps saying over and over that the Iranians are begging him to talk. And the Iranian officials were saying, can you imagine Abbas Araghchi, the foreign minister of Iran, like texting Steve Witkoff, the guy who he was supposedly negotiating with when they turned around and bombed? He absolutely has not.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the guy's negotiating with you, promising that they're going to have a deal, and then he lies to you, and the next day your country is being bombed. And now he calls you on the phone. Are you going to talk to him? Would you? Would you talk to that guy? I don't know. It's like somebody saying, trust me, and then they kill your family. Is that your friend or your enemy? You tell me. Let me know. Write to me. Scahill, by the way, is a real reporter. If this guy's saying it, it's usually because his contacts are pretty good. And now I'm going to show you what passes for reporting in the United States. Just the opposite. Bad reporting. Look at this frightened-looking woman asking Abbas, again, Araghchi. And he seems to be telling her, telling her what she doesn't want to hear. And by the way, she's not asking. She's pretty much telling him that he and the Iranians should quit this war and just sit down and negotiate. And then she looks surprised by his answers. Like, she doesn't really even know what's going on. She's in a bubble, right? A bubble. Fun word to say. She also seems upset that Iran has the audacity to attack and defend itself after being attacked. She seems, let me put it to you this way. She almost looks like she's arguing with talking points that were written down for her by Bibi Netanyahu, which is very likely given the fact that she works for CBS, which is owned by Israel. Watch.
Has Iran asked for a ceasefire?
No, we never asked for a ceasefire. And we have never asked even for negotiation. We are ready to defend ourselves as long as it takes.
Iran is sending its drones and its missiles into your neighboring countries, American allies throughout the Gulf. If your government survives this conflict, how do you go back to doing business with countries you're sending drones into?
Obviously, these are the countries who have given their soil to American forces to attack us. So what can we do? We just sit and watch that American forces are attacking us from their soil?
I almost think she asked the question without knowing that the United States has 30 military installations in those countries. And she doesn't tell you that. She says, oh, you're just dropping bombs on these innocent people who live in these countries, without even mentioning that those countries have U.S. military installations from where the United States is using satellites to attack Iran. I'm not taking sides here. I'm just telling you that that's an important part of the story that she's not telling you. And again, damn it, that's not journalism. So what does Mr. Trump do right now? The war is not going well. And yesterday, he got really bad economic news. GDP in the last quarter of 2025 was 0.7 in the United States. 0.7. That's GDP growth. You know, they always measure and they tell you this quarter we expect growth of 1% or 2%. In this case, they were expecting 1.4%. They got half. GDP growth in the United States was 0.7%. That's terrible. It's not a good number for Mr. Trump, who, by the way, I don't know. You tell me. I'm going to play him here for you so you can see the video. He looks tired, right, already. And the reporting is that he wants this thing over very soon. Publicly, he's saying if it turns into another Vietnam, I'm okay with that. Here, somebody's about to ask him that.
In Iran, because the Iranian regime has told Sky News, if you put boots on the ground in Iran, it will be another Vietnam. Are you afraid of that?
No, I'm really not afraid of anything.
So, What happens then? What happens if this does turn into another Vietnam? What happens if the United States sends the Marines in and puts boots on the ground, as everybody loves to say? Then what happens? And what's going to happen, not just with this war, but with the entire region? We're not talking about one country. We're talking about a very big country surrounded by other big countries. Let's go to the map. And we're going to talk to our battlefield guy, Stanislav Karpivnik. He's a U.S. Army soldier, more recently a much sought-after military expert. Ever since we started putting him on the air, everybody wants him now. But he's good. He's very good at explaining exactly what's going on in the military theater. He has a podcast now, by the way, if you want to check him out. It's Mr. Slavic Man, because he is a Slavic man. Let's go to the big map. So what happens if this becomes a ground war? We're at the big map now, and we're going to take you through this. Now, keep in mind, this was supposed to be a 2 or 3 day operation. That's what Mr. Trump believed. Since then, obviously, it's gotten a lot more complicated. And now Mr. Trump is actually talking, since we're now into well past the second week, he's talking about this actually turning into something much more akin to the experiences the United States has had in Iraq, for example, or Afghanistan, or even going back, Vietnam and Korea. It's not what the American people want, but apparently it's what's under consideration right now. So if this turned into a ground war, a boots on the ground, as a lot of people call it, what would it look like? What would happen? What would happen to Iran? What would happen to the region? And maybe more importantly, what would happen to the U.S. forces? And how do they even get them in here? These are all the questions that I've had, and that's why I'm inviting Stas to join us now. Stas, thanks for being with us as usual.
Always a pleasure.
Boy, I don't know where we begin, but I guess let's look at the big map and let's look at the possibilities. You have four possibilities for entry in terms of where U.S. troops would have to go or land or be parachuted in or be brought in by vessel, et cetera. I think the first place you talked about is the area up around Turkey, right?
I'd even say five because I've added Karg Island onto this list now. So five places. Right. So first of all, I'd like to say I hope to God Trump has enough common sense not to do this. It's going to be a disaster. It's going to be a disaster not just for Iranians. Of course, it's going to be a disaster for America. And American forces are going to get massive casualties. So I'm praying that he's got enough common sense there. He won't do it. But if he does do it, so we've got... Iranian Kurdistan through Turkey.
Okay. And we're seeing that right there at the top of the map. I think you guys can see it at home. That's that area above Syria, above Iraq, and that's where would be one of the first places where it might be possible to get enough troops in.
Right, because you can drop them in and drive them across Turkey. Right. The other place would be probably the most sane place, because the Turks aren't too thrilled with this. They don't want a Kurdistan on their border,
right?
Because they've got lots of Kurds, and they don't want them seeking independence again. So they're not thrilled with it. The most sane place would be through Azerbaijan. Extremely long logistics. But through Azerbaijan, and Azerbaijan would have to declare war on Iran, and then that would be a fight through the mountains. Either one would be a fight through the mountains.
That's a mountainous area, and
Absolutely.
As you can see, it's a pretty good border. It's a pretty long border between Azerbaijan and Iran.
Yeah, that southern portion right there, they could go in there. They could build up a place like there's airports near Baku and those areas that they could build up on. But again, more likely the Iranians will start hitting those airports the moment they see U.S. troops starting to build up
so
in that area.
They're not going to wait. From a geopolitical standpoint, that would be very difficult.
That would be difficult from a logistics standpoint, too, because long logistics lines. But there's no short logistic lines anywhere here.
All right, and we're talking generalities now. We're going to get into specifics later, but let's go to number three. What would you say?
Number three would be through southern Iraq and Kuwait. And again, Iraqi militias are fighting actively against American forces. They're besieged American forces in all three of those bases. The Green Zone in Baghdad is getting hit on a daily basis with drones and light artillery and mortar fire. So there's already 2,000 Americans trapped up there. But they could go through Kuwait. But again, they'd have to go through Kuwait, go through a little bit of Iraq, and then into this low-lying area of Iran. But the moment they get past these low-lying areas, and there are oil fields there, once they get past that area, it's all mountain again. So if they're going to Tehran, which is up here, They have to go through all of these mountains.
But is, but by the way, this last choice you gave us, which is a combination of Kuwait and Iraq, aren't the U.S. forces getting pounded right now by the Iraqi militias?
Iraqi militias are pounding them. Iranian ballistic missiles are pounding them. Iraqi drones are pounding them. Iranian drones are pounding them. So yes.
How do you put people in an unfriendly terrain like that? I mean, before they even start fighting, they're already kind of fighting just to dig in.
Right. And that's another thing that most people forget. Operation Desert Storm, Desert Shield,
yeah,
6 months to build up.
Right.
6 months.
That's
my
point.
And that's when nobody firing
right
on them.
Exactly.
The Iraq invasion 2003, which, by the way, took 22 days to get to Baghdad. And that's considering half the Iraqi army never left its barracks because the generals have been bought off by the CIA. It was still a 3 month period to build up. And nobody was firing on them during those 3 months. Iran is not going to sit around and wait. They're going to be putting down munitions on top.
So that's a perilous situation to try and get the guys in there to do that. So let's go now to the Persian.
It gets worse. It gets worse.
Okay.
Right.
I'll get it. Continue.
I know we're going to zoom in, but that little dot right there is Karg Island.
Yeah.
So they're talking about Karg Island now. Look how close Karg Island is to Iran. So all the drones can come flying. Look how far away he is from everywhere else. Try to feed the guys there. Try to bring them ammunition into that area.
Right. And armies, what's the expression about armies? Through their stomachs?
Armies travel on their stomachs.
It's travel on their stomachs. Yeah. Thank you very much.
They live and die by logistics.
Let's go to the Persian Gulf, I guess, or did you want to talk about Saudi Arabia?
No. Well, even there, if we're going to go across, you know, to get the assets across, you have to get them across Saudi Arabia anyway. So there's ports on the Red Sea that you can bring them in, but look at the logistics line that has to go all the way across the desert in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis already basically said, we're neutral, so we're not getting involved. So there's a big question whether they would even allow the U.S. forces to build up.
That's another really great question. Of all of these places that you've mentioned so far, and we're yet to go in tight on the Persian Gulf, which of the people in this region are saying, oh, absolutely, we're in. We want to be a part of this.
Well, Egypt's staying somewhat neutral, but would probably go okay. Jordan's all in.
Militarily.
Right. The Sunni jihadists that are now holding power in Syria are in. Mm-hmm. Of course, the Alawites and the Christians are still fighting them aren't in. So that's a mix. Turkey would probably allow American forces across. Iraq, while the government is officially not here, not there, but the militias are all fighting against
Got
the
U.S.
forces.
Yeah.
So there's already conflict there. And Saudi Arabia basically said we're neutral.
And so, none of the Gulf countries are in. They're saying,
well,
hell no.
UAE's in and Bahrain's in, but Bahrain's an island. And UAE is not exactly, I mean, even if UAE is in, look, you still have to get forces up to this area. But just to get them across into the northern portion of the Straits of Hormuz, which they're also talking about.
But here's the problem. What you're saying is government officials and members of the military who have a long-standing relationship with Israel and the United States are saying, sure, we'll go in and help. Let's take Bahrain, for example.
Mm-hmm.
80 to 90% of the people are Shias.
Right.
They would be really pissed if their government did this.
Absolutely.
Same as in Jordan, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
In so many of these countries, the people would say, no, we won't stand for this, right? So that's a problem.
And there's a question right now, even Bahrain, who's in charge? Because there's rumors that the king's fled. The Saudis have moved in their security forces on day three because the whole island's exploded into revolution.
Yeah.
So there's a big question. Can you even keep the American bases that are there right now? They're being dismembered on the spot. I'll tell you another thing, which shocked me as a guy that spent his time in the armor and in the infantry. What I was told through very, very good sources is those bases, American bases, they don't have bunkers. They never built bunkers. Air Force, Navy never built bunkers.
Is that why those guys are all staying in hotels?
Yeah, that's by the way also why. So these bases, they were considering that if there was a conflict, it would only be 3 or 4 days.
Gosh.
And their anti-air systems would be enough to defend them. Conflict is what, we're on day 19 right now?
God bless them.
Almost 3 weeks?
Yeah, that's tough.
The anti-aircraft systems are either destroyed or they're out of missiles. And they have no place to hide. So the Iranians right now are destroying the infrastructure. But sooner or later, they're going to go in. And the videos that came out yesterday was Iranian drones in Kuwait just flying randomly. I mean, FPV drones flying around looking for targets. They've got free access.
Yeah. You saw my interview with Ted from MIT. And he said The only thing that's being shot down is about 5%.
Exactly.
That's it. That means 95% are getting through. Let's talk about the Gulf. Yeah, we promised we were going to talk about the Gulf. Do we have a tighter shot of the Gulf, Gene? I don't know if we do or not, but I think it's let's go to the Persian Gulf area with the cutout of the Karg Island. If we have that map, that would be great to show that now. Let's put that. There you go. There you go.
Beautiful.
So there's a good shot of the Persian Gulf. And in a little bit, I'm going to ask him to show you Karg Island. But let's stay here and tell us how possibly the United States could, using vessels, I guess, get Marines into that area of Iran.
So first of all, while at the narrowest point, the Straits of Hormuz are about 32 kilometers.
Yeah.
The actual strait through which you can take in the super heavy tankers, the oil tankers, the dredged area, it's 2,700 meters wide.
That's nothing.
That's less than 3 kilometers. That's like 2 miles. That's less than 2 miles wide.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it.
That's enough that's navigability of about 6 or 7 ships.
At max. And that's if any of them don't get destroyed sideways.
Right. You blow one up and then, now you got room for one. You blow two up, you're stopped. Nothing
exactly.
can get through.
And if you look, so if U.S. troops land here and try to take this green zone right here, which is the coastal strip. Now, you can bring them in different ways. You can bring them in by helicopter. You can bring them in if through Oman, you can bring in U.S. forces and move them up into north of Dubai in this area and try to throw them across. Never mind the casualties, because the Iranians are just going to sit around and wait. They're going to be droning them. And you know what the worst drones they can do? They can take 200-300 teenagers, put them up in those mountains under some ledge or some tree, give them an IR visor, give them about 20 drones, let's play a game. And under each one of these big drones, you put an RPG round, which is, by the way, what happens in Ukraine constantly. And let's play a game. Let's see how many drones. You got 200-300 drone waves coming in. They're going to get through.
And what I'm reading is that these little aluminum drones with a warhead on it, not really a warhead, it's just like a bomb or a small, what would you call it?
It's an RPG grenade, grenade that they attach underneath it.
Those things are a couple grand.
Yeah.
They're a couple thousand dollars.
They're not aluminum, they're plastic.
And they're knocking out facilities inside the GCC. Which is amazing that they're able to do this. And I also, one more thing I'll tell you. I just read an interview with the U.S. Admiral in charge of the Persian Gulf, who said, even if we went in there with minesweepers, because of the new drone warfare, those minesweepers would be basically knocked out right away. Right. It would take us at least 3 months to open the Gulf if we tried to do it with minesweepers.
And that's having to pull the wrecks back out, dredge them out.
So what you're saying is that the drones are a game changer.
Absolutely. At this point in time in technology, the drones are a game changer. You don't need to have huge bases. You just take a couple thousand teenagers. You want revenge for your families getting hit. Yeah. There you go. And they're sitting under some tree on a mountaintop looking down there, and they're moving, flying the drones.
So what you're saying is that makes it either improbable or impossible that we could navigate our way in there with Marines and put them on the shores of Kish Island or Karg, for example.
Well, they could come across, but, I mean, they're going to take losses. Here you could push the Iranians far enough back that you get them out of range, but that means you have to go in the mountains and you have to start fighting them in the mountains where they're sitting there waiting. There's 100,000 Iranians dug into bases, and they're waiting for the American military to get there. They're literally, what their Minister of Foreign Affairs said, we're waiting for you. They've been getting ready for 20 years waiting to massacre whatever goes up there.
Let's go in tight on Karg Island if we could. Let's walk over here. Gene, give me a pullout and give me a magnification, if you can, of Karg Island so we can see.
Beautiful map.
Yeah, talk to us about this and why this is suddenly what everybody's talking about.
Well, this is a very historic spot before we're going to look at that for tourist-wise. But this area right here is oil loading facilities. So they pump the oil in, they clean the oil up from sand, from whatever other chemicals.
Yep.
You have cleaning facilities, store it, and then the ships come up here and they fill the storage.
And this is where Iran's oil goes to China and all over the world.
But this isn't the only place. Now, Iran has 5 oil loading facilities. This is the main one. But if you take this out of Iran's hands or destroy it, that's not it. I mean, Iran still has others. It'll be damaged. But Iran can still load and ship
oil.
But
to do that, you're going to need Marines.
Absolutely. Marines, airborne, air assault.
82nd Airborne, 101st probably Rangers.
Yeah. 101st Air Assault, you can bring. But the problem is, look at this island. First of all, this airstrip, we bombed, the U.S. bombed this airstrip.
Yeah, so, I think we may have some pics of those. Guys, you're welcome to put those up if you have them, by the way. We've got the video of this actually taking place. In fact, if we have it, here it is. You want to take a look at this? Let's put it up. There it is. Take a look at the monitor over there. This is what the U.S. military has put out. As you can see, it's unclassified. This is the bombing of Karg Island. And I guess, what are they trying to do here, Stas?
There were military facilities at Karg Island. There's the airport area. Yeah. They bombed the airstrip. So now you can't bring in C-130s because there's only about 3,000 meters, and they need 3,500 meters. Feet in this case. So about 1,500 meters.
Right.
They need more strip to land safely. So your C-130s, they can't deliver enough cargo. You've got most of your big planes can't land on it until it's repaired. And repairing it, consider how close that island is to the shoreline, it's going to be droned every single day. Any guys on here are going to be running around looking for a place to save their
lives. So last week when Hegseth and these guys say Karg Island's going to be the magic bullet for us, it's going to be the place where we can do this, you think that's bullcrap?
The problem in the West, in particular, along the leadership and U.S. Specifically, is everybody's always looking for that silver bullet. There's never a silver bullet. It always has to be a big approach. It's always going to be expensive. There's always going to be multiple factors. There's not going to be one. We take this one island, we conquer everybody. We kill this one guy, we conquer everybody. It never works that way. But they're always looking for it because, for people that don't want to think too hard, it's a simple answer.
But here's the problem. The United States thought this was going to be like the 12-day war. In fact, they thought it was going to be half of the 12-day war.
4 days.
Right?
Yeah,
and they were going to be in and out of there. Now we're seeing this resistance from the Iranians, who have really dug in, and they're doing a lot of damage. I think Mr. Trump feels a lot of pressure. I want you to listen to Arachi. Mm-hmm. This is Arachi talking to Margaret Brenner. She's a horrible reporter, like most of them are in the United States. You would think she's asking questions that were sent to her by Bibi Netanyahu. And here she is asking, well, you'll see for yourself. Here she is asking Arachi, essentially, I believe, why don't you surrender and why don't you negotiate? And listen to his answer. Let's play that, Gene, if you got it.
President Trump said this weekend he is not ready to make a deal with Iran because the terms aren't good enough yet. His administration is saying this war could last another 3.5 weeks or so. Has Iran asked for a ceasefire?
No, we never asked for a ceasefire, and we have never asked even for negotiation.
She makes it sound, she makes it sound with her question like it's the other way around. Like, you know, we understand that you've reached out and you want to negotiate with the Trump administration. And he's like, no, they're calling us, which, by the way, there's new reporting just this morning by one of the best reporters in the business who's saying he has it on good authority that the U.S., through back channels, has reached out to Arachi and said, we're ready to deal. What do you want? And these guys are saying, no, we're not ready to deal. We're going to keep fighting.
As a matter of fact, the first reports of this happened day five, day six. They're reaching out through the Italians to get the Italians to talk to the Iranians that let's have a ceasefire. So they've been doing this for two weeks. They can't get an answer.
So here's where that gets this conversation. If it's true, and it looks like the Iranians are not willing to deal, what's left for Trump? But this scenario that you and I are explaining.
Look, Trump politically is going to take a massive hit, and the Republican Party is going to make a massive hit from this stupidity that they've unleashed on the world. The best thing right now is cut and run. Is say, okay, we won, mission accomplished, we're going home.
Declare victory.
Israel's going to continue getting hit because the Iranians aren't done. But, okay, so we've done everything we can for Israel, you're on your own.
Make them the bad guys.
Dasvidanya.
So we left, and they're still hitting and killing people.
And dasvidanya. We're leaving. That's the best scenario.
That's a political solution.
That's a political solution. But the donor-owner class isn't going to be happy with Trump if they do that. Because they've bought Trump to stand there to the end, right?
Why? Because they make money from war.
They make money from war. They have compromise. I'm pretty sure they have some kind of material on him or other people that, you know.
And they want the oil.
And they want the oil.
Iran has one of the biggest oil reserves in the world.
There's the Greater Israel Project that they talk about now all the time that encompasses all of this. So,
all right, before we get too far into weeds with geopolitics, which I think is another fantastic conversation, by the way, can you give me the map, if you could, of the Kurdistan region? That orange area. Let me put this up for you. We're going to show you Kurdistan. Kurdistan, A lot of people around the world don't know this. Kurdistan is vast.
It is.
Look at everything you see in orange here, folks. That's Kurdistan. And as you can see, it's part of Iraq. It's part of Iran. It's part of Armenia. It's part of Syria. But most of all, it's Turkey. So right. for of all the potential plans for getting boots on the ground, you say this is the primordial one. This is the best of the worst of the choices.
Well, the best one is Azerbaijan, but the second best is through Kurdistan. Right. So these are the two. Either way.
So you say Azerbaijan is one, and then
Going through Iranian Kurdistan is the second.
Interesting.
Now the Kurds inside Iran have said no, we're not going to do this. But the exiled Kurdish parties from Iran that are in Iraq said, yeah, we're not against this. Now the Kurds in Syria have just been massacred by al-Jalani when Trump said, you know, we're done with you, we don't need you anymore.
Yeah.
Head Choppers Incorporated, have fun, murder them off. So a lot of Kurds in Iraq, they're not very thrilled with this idea because they just saw what happened to their cousins and maybe their brothers and sisters just across this border they don't recognize. So that's one part. Turkey, the other major part, though, is the Turks. They don't want any independent Kurdistan in Iran because look at how much of their territory is Kurdistan. And those people want independence from Turkey.
And to make our viewers understand, the reason you're mentioning this is because the United States government wants to align with the Kurds
right.
to go in and go over the border right. into Iran.
Okay. Right.
And the Turks say, no, we don't. We're not going to allow that.
Exactly. They're not thrilled with that idea, at the least. They may be strong on.
And they're a NATO country.
They are a NATO country. So you would have they're the second major army in NATO.
You would have two NATO countries bucking each other.
Yeah, you would. But Azerbaijan, the problem with Azerbaijan is, look at the logistics line. You'd have to go through the Black Sea or across Turkey, across this little Trump highway that they've gotten through in Armenia, and then into Azerbaijan. The logistics is insane. And Iran is not going to sit there and wait for them to build up. As soon as they see that they're building up, and Azerbaijan would have to declare war on Iran if American forces go in. They're just preempted.
You're an American military guy, so you know that in the United States, the buzzword has always been two words, really. Another Vietnam. Another Vietnam. Are we looking at another Vietnam? So I want to play something for you. Here's the president of the United States yesterday in the Oval Office taking questions from a reporter, and one of them says, Mr. President, are you about to embark on another Vietnam? Watch his reaction. I want to get your take on this. Let's hit this, if you could, Boris and Jean.
In Iran, because the Iranian regime has told Sky News, if you put boots on the ground in Iran, it will be another Vietnam. Are you afraid of that?
No, I'm not afraid of... I'm really not afraid of anything.
He's not afraid of anything.
That's a sign of a bad leader. If he has no fear, he's so... He's so certain about himself. That is...
But certitude is impressive, maybe sometimes in board meetings, but in war, it gets people killed.
Hubris, arrogance, and ignorance. Those are three sisters that really like to go together on dates.
Hubris, arrogance, and ignorance. Does he have all three?
Oh, he's got all three in spades. And the worst part is, this won't be a Vietnam. Vietnam is Vietnam. This is going to be a Korea. Mountain fighting with an enemy that's organized, and is willing to take casualties to destroy whoever comes in on their own home turf in the mountains.
So my historical knowledge and my old age would tell me that at best you could say about Vietnam, it was a draw. In Korea, it's safe to say the United States got its ass kicked.
In the end, it was a draw, but yes, the United States got driven out of all of North Korea by the Chinese.
Was it the weather, the Chinese? It was really the Chinese drove them out, right?
I mean,
it's hard to look at that and say, oh, yeah, no. Yeah, we were the winners in Korea. I don't think so.
No. Well, the conflict is still going on. It's an armistice.
Yeah.
So the conflict actually never ended in Korea, so...
That's sad.
Yeah.
I feel terrible for the troops.
I know.
This thing with Joe Kent yesterday, which is the big story that everybody's talking about, what kind of message does that send? I mean, you were a soldier. What message do the soldiers get when they hear the highest-ranking security official in the United States say there was no imminent threat from this country that we're at war with, and we did it because of another country, Israel?
Look, you know, if Joe Kent had resigned before this started, went to the public and said, went to the media and said, look, this is a situation. We don't need to be going here. I've resigned in protest. I could take the person very seriously that he's got the convictions. Day 18, the ship's sinking. It's obviously sinking. He just looks to me anyways, he looks like the first strat off the ship. Wow. I'm running ahead of the sinking. The Titanic's going down. It keeps ramming that iceberg. He's the first one off the boat.
Final question.
But not the last one.
Final question for you, because I'm really interested, because I think you're so smart and you understand, and you're looking at all the signs. Given all the signs that you've been seeing so far and everything that you've seen out there, are the signs so far to you indicating that this will be a boots-on-the-ground situation, that there will be an invasion of Iran?
You know, I pray there's enough common sense in Washington left to say no. I'm afraid there isn't. Vietnam, if we're going to go down to Vietnam, started with one American battalion to defend one airport, and then it ballooned out to 500,000 men. U.S. doesn't have 500,000 men it can spare. Because, by the way, out of the half a million, the U.S. Army, two-thirds are the guys in the rear that aren't combat soldiers, actually more than that even. There would have to be a draft. If any of this really gets in there and they keep expanding you will have to have a draft. And by the way, what I've been told by very good sources, it would take 6 months to get the first people in because selective service is in a total mess. They have to reorganize
it. Do you know what the Persian Gulf would look like 6 months from now if this thing continues without somebody crying uncle?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the global oil situation already is about $1.20 or something like that?
It's not just the oil. The worst thing is it's planting season.
Yeah.
Russia's 40% of the world's chemical fertilizer. The Gulf is another 30% of the world. That's 70%. The EU's not cut itself off from everything. So they may have famine in Europe.
25% of LNG comes out of there. 30% of the fertilizer comes out of there. 20% of the oil comes out of there. I mean, when you just add all these things up, and then you say, let's look at this situation 6 months from now, it's not a pretty picture.
Now imagine, unless the U.S. government walks in and puts caps on gasoline prices and export caps so that it doesn't start flowing out to more expensive markets, I don't think they'll do it because the donor-owner class will take a hit then. American taxpayers are going to be broke.
Are you convinced that these guys went into this without thinking a lot of this stuff that you and I are talking about through?
Absolutely.
They really thought this was going to be over lickety-split.
Look at Venezuela. Okay, plan A, we capture Maduro. Plan B. I mean,
saying that we thought they knock out the Ayatollah and this thing's over.
And then we do what we want. Of course, they don't plan. They've got the step one, and then they got the conclusion, and everything in between. That's the fuzzy map.
Well, that's terrible. For U.S. soldiers because you know they don't deserve something like this. My friend, are so good at this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, as usual, Stas, for taking us through this, and thank you once again for being with us and for following us every step of the way. As I mentioned, we're up to, I think I just saw this morning, we're getting about 22 million people now who are tuning in just to see what we're saying each and every day and throughout the week, and we really are humbled that so many of you trust us to bring you the information. You can find us, of course, not just on the air, but you can also find much of what we do when we post our videos and social media. We're on BitChute, we are on Spotify, we are on X, and we are on YouTube. And, of course, we invite you to go there and tell us what you think. And we'll tell the rest of the world what you think as well, because oftentimes we share your comments. To you, once again, my thanks. And, of course, Stas, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Always a
pleasure. And we'll be looking for you next time.